Welcome to the Manager Tools Members Only Cast. Today's topic, the interview with John Lucht, part one of three. Hi everyone, this is Mike, and welcome back. Today we have a special treat for you. As a matter of fact, today we're publishing the very first podcast we've ever done with someone other than Mark and me. Mark and I recently had an opportunity to meet with John Lucht, and today you get to hear the first part. And the entire interview is over 90 minutes, so we're going to break this up into three separate casts. If you're not familiar with John's work, I have to tell you, you're missing something special. John Lucht, the author of Rites of Passage, has been an executive recruiter for the past three decades. And when it comes to advice of the ins and outs of job searching, there is no one better. No one. Mark and I have been huge fans of John's work for over a decade, and it was distinctly our pleasure to be able to meet with John and get some of his insight on some of the topics that are near and dear to everybody's hearts here. So, without further ado, here's the first of three parts of the interview. Enjoy.
We are thrilled that you are here. The fact that that I've finally gotten to meet you after telling everyone about your book for years and years and years is just a treat for me. You will be the first ever interview, the first ever non-Mark or Mike voice.
Oh, really?
For
heaven's sakes, yeah. I'm intruding.
No.
We've been asked a number of times. Yeah.
You know what it's like. People ask you to review their books, right? People ask you to introduce them to people. And you have to know the person, you have to trust them, and so on.
Sure.
We get books all the time. Please review this book. Please talk about it on your blog because of the size of our audience. And we've said no. And we get comments once a week. Please broaden your perspectives and so on. When it comes to management, for basic managers, we're just like you in the sense that that's what we think about. You think about recruitment, you think about placement, you think about clients, and we have tons to share for years and years and years to come, and yet the opportunity to have you on is, we said to ourselves, okay, we have a standard for what we want to deliver to our audience, to the managers who listen. We're in like 170 countries now. People are listening all over the world.
All over the world, yeah.
And our standard is here. It doesn't make any sense for us if we could do a podcast next week that is at this standard, that we would bring somebody on and go down a level, right? We want somebody who raises it a level. Okay. And your book, I'll tell you, John, your book changed my professional life in terms of not only explaining some of the behind-the-scenes stuff about recruiting firms,
sure,
and the subtleties and so on, but more importantly, it was written in the style that I would want to write a book in. In fact, I'm sure you remember this. I'm sure I told you this on the phone when we first talked. There's a line, the I don't know what you call it, the foreword or the inscription of your book. Uh-huh. This is what I tell my friends.
Yes, I wanted to write something short and to the point and that covers it.
Yeah.
And that's the truth of the matter, too, because some of what's in there is the sort of thing that perhaps would be kind of held back.
Right. I was reading, I kept going, this is the thing that I want everyone, that I kind of knew, but nobody's ever validated. And now a guy who's been in the business for 20 years has validated it.
It's all authentic, for gosh sakes, it is. And it's fair.
Yes.
It takes on retainer recruiters, contingency recruiters,
right,
and it treats both of them fairly. So originally it was resisted by both retainer and contingency recruiters. When it first came out, the New York Times was going to do a review of my book and a book by the head of one of the biggest recruiting firms. And the head of another recruiting firm managed to suppress that dual review. It never did get it. And then the irony of it all was that the fellow who had enough clout with the Times to suppress the review of Rites of Passage sent me his nephew, who was you know, close in his family, wanted me to help him with his career. Oh,
so he suppressed you, but then he still
right, like, right. But then the irony of that was, in order to help his nephew, I gave him a copy of the book.
Of course.
He said, "This is incredible. I want to review it." And he wanted to review it for the L.A. Times, where he does some reviews, because he had been with a major publication outside the country here, was coming in. That was his idea, was to re-arrive and work here. But anyway, enough about that.
Yeah.
Let's see what we can talk about that will help your
good
readers.
Okay, so
your listeners.
So the first question that I sent you is, if after all your years of experience and seeing thousands of people placed and talking to interviewers and interviewees and candidates and hiring firms and so on, what one piece of advice? And I know you've got 50, but if you had to pick one, what would it be?
I thought about that because you did send it to me, and I came up with two things as far as that one question is concerned. One is, make yourself known to all of the people that can be helpful. Don't be a tree that, you know, was in the forest and it fell, nobody heard it. So make yourself known. And two, know your market. Try to find out where there are potential jobs that you would be appropriate for and try to put yourself in the way of selection for that.
Okay.
When I did the website that accompanies the book.
This is RightSight.
RightSight.com.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I especially attacked those two issues because those were the things that I thought I could help people with. And sometimes it's a little easier than you would even imagine it to be. At least there are some obvious things and some that are not so obvious. But anyway, there are sometimes people think that they shouldn't be widely known, that there's some kind of a disadvantage to being widely known.
So the fact is,
if it's retainer recruiters, there's no disadvantage to being widely known because every retainer recruiter is being paid to fill a specific job, and they are not going to send your resume around for free because that's what the contingency recruiters do. And we have made it a point on RightSight to keep tabs on who are the authentic 100% retained firms. It doesn't count if you do an occasional retainer search, but you'd love to do more, but you're mainly contingency. So we really do work on that, and we have now, I think, 597 firms. A couple weeks ago it was 596, but we kicked one off, found a new one, and found another one. And so we're very concerned about that. And there's no downside.
Right.
No downside to being known to retainer firms because they don't tell each other. They don't engage each other in anything they're doing. Incidentally, the one that we kicked out recently turned out to do something which is absolutely the nature of the contingency business. He got unsolicited resumes, and this firm had been in my book for maybe a decade, and I thought very highly of them. They sent their son away to college. He came back from school, went into the firm, and decided, you know what, the extra resumes that we have no use for, I can feed those into one of the contingency networks, and I might get a split fee if I did. So all of a sudden, the very thing that we were trying to protect against, one of them was doing.
Right.
It took us only 15 minutes to get him off our list.
Right.
But here's a reputation that his parents had made for years and didn't take long to, as far as we're concerned, to destroy it.
Take a minute, John, if you would, because we've got some of our listeners are either aspiring managers or they've been a manager for a year or two. You take it for granted. Mike and I know what you mean, but take a minute and describe retainer and contingency.
Okay. And also, I will, though we just said something that might seem negative to contingency, recognizing that you span the entire spectrum, the contingency recruiters and their widespread publication of resumes is a very positive thing when you're a junior person just starting out.
Right.
So, you know, jump in. The water's fine, and the more people that know about you, the better. there isn't any downside to it particularly. Now, the contingency recruiters are the ones who get paid only if somebody is hired. It's just like a real estate broker. If there's no transaction, there's no payment. And therefore, the object of the game is to get as many resumes out to as many potential employers as you possibly can, just like the real estate agent would like to show as many houses or apartments as possible and hope to get a sale. Mm-hmm. It's a numbers game. Inflating the numbers helps. Now, the retainer recruiters, and the reason there are so very few of them, are able to make a harsher bargain. They can tell their potential clients, look, if you want us to do the work for you, if you want us to look and fill your position with somebody who's highly appropriate and perhaps the best person maybe in the country, or at least one of the very best people for the job, if you want that, you want our level of work on this thing, you've got to pay us to do it. And you pay us while we work. And we get paid whether or not you change your mind and don't hire anybody. We get paid whether or not you like the people that we have. We get paid even if you ask us to interview your internal candidates, and we tell you the internal candidates are better than the external ones.
Mm-hmm.
So the retainer recruiter has the higher level jobs. They have each job exclusively. And to the point that we talked about before, there's no advantage in not being known to a lot of them, as many as possible. Of our 597, perhaps 50 of them or so are specialists. They don't do anything except healthcare material management or whatever it is.
Right.
So those you don't particularly want to send your resume to, but we have an automated tool that will send your resume to the ones that are generalists and that are in your specialty. We have a way so that you can scan a whole field, and the default, the presumed setting is that you do want to send.
Right.
And so you probably want to send to all of the generalists if they're not ones that you have already dealt with, because you certainly don't want to come in as a stranger from the cold among people that you already have a nice relationship with. But after you just kind of deselect those, then it's a great benefit to be able to have your resume zapped by electronic means into all of those appropriate companies. So that's kind of you want to be known to these retainer recruiters, but the retainer recruiters are not going to, if this question comes up next in most people's mind, won't I get too much action? Won't I get more than I can handle?
Oh, I love that one. Oh, gosh, it'll just be too many. I can't possibly deal with it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you should wish.
Yeah, right, yeah.
It's not going to happen because these people are highly paid to find exactly what's needed. It's not a smart idea to say, I know this great person who could do almost anything.
Right.
Doesn't know anything specifically about your field, but
fabulous
boy, is he
person, good.
You would really like him. You could try to get by as a retainer recruiter on sending people like that, but it doesn't work. Now, on the other hand, from the individual's point of view, and we're talking about $100,000 plus people, they're the ones that the retainer recruiters are concerned with, maybe more like 150 or even 200,000 as a threshold for retainer recruiters to be interested and paid to go find them. But with respect to those people, the recruiter is going to be very interested in finding out who the people are, but very discriminating and not showing the client anybody who's inappropriate.
Right. Mm.
They're being paid lots of money to go find the right thing. They're not going to bring the wrong thing. Now, a point, though, before we pass over it, I wanted to mention. Usually, in the retainer recruiter's group of candidates, and different recruiters have different MOs, even different recruiters within a large firm will have different patterns. But generally speaking, when they present candidates to their client, it's somewhere between 4 and 6 candidates. I always like to present 6. That was my number. And I think it's a pretty prevalent number, not the only one.
Right.
Now, out of 6, it's kind of a neat idea to present one wild card. One person who is extremely attractive,
right,
is extremely able, has great credentials, has done wonderful things in another field. Now, you can't populate your list with those people, but one can get through,
right,
and it shows that you thought more broadly about it. Naturally, you choose somebody that you know is going to be well-liked by the client, and you also choose somebody who can be trained and brought up to speed very quickly, somebody who will probably be a good choice. You wouldn't want to present somebody who is not going to be a success,
right?
Because how does your business go after that? You know, you give them a turkey, and that's your client relationship is over with. So it's naive on the part of the people who think that they can, that they're so attractive and so intelligent and they've done so well in their field that therefore what they have is applicable to everybody in every field.
Right.
It isn't, and not as far as somebody who's being paid one third of compensation. $33,000, $100,000, $200,000 being paid to find this person better fit.
Right. We had a mutual friend who came out of another field and said, you know, I can do anything.
Yeah.
Just give me a staff of five or six people, you know, $200,000 and I can do anything.
Yeah. Like, and you just see that, well, obviously you haven't talked to anybody who's halfway intelligent. Let me tell you something that I've been saying to my friends for years, John. And by the way, I'll tell our listeners this story. I think I've mentioned to them before. Your book was the book, I've told many people about it. I've had more copies, I've bought more single copies of your book than any other book I've ever bought. The closest one is Effective Executive. I've bought probably 50, but I've probably bought over 100, maybe close to 200 copies of your book. And what I always had was I always had 3 or 4 or 5 on my shelf so that when somebody called me and said, I need some help, I just say, look, we could spend hours. I could. And you and I know each other. But look, John's a lot smarter than me. Just read this guy's book. And I remember a couple of times going to before Amazon.
I was, by the way, one of those friends who
read this book. And I love the fact of telling you.
You wind up going, choosing to partner up with this guy.
He's crazy. I remember one time telling somebody, I says, I'll tell you how great this book is. Look what it says in the introduction. It says, this is what I tell my friends. And I said, it's so easy. John's telling his friends. I'm telling my friends, just read this book. But here's what I've been telling them. When they, most people, when they start reading, they don't have any idea that you're going to demystify the whole contingent versus retained recruiters. People just assume they're not going to ever know it. And you do that in the book. Well, one of the things that I told people, and this is my shorthand, and I want you to tell me if I've been wrong for all the years, and it's okay. Believe me, if you tell my listeners they're wrong, I've been wrong, they will love it, and they'll rib me about it for years. What I told them was this. If you want an overly simple way of separating contingency from retainer firms, it is simply this. Retained firms are search firms. That is, they are paid to search. Contingency firms are placement firms in that they get paid when they place somebody.
In other words, they're marketing people versus hunting for people.
Exactly.
What you're saying.
And it's just, you can get paid as a retained firm. Obviously, retained firms aren't going to be successful if they bring a lot of good people, but they never tend to get hires out of the group that they bring.
Sure. They've got to solve the problem.
Yes, exactly.
If the first group of candidates is deemed inappropriate, even if it's because the client is wrong.
Right, yeah.
Even if the client is being obnoxious about it, still it's a service business.
Yeah.
And so you will bring another group. But one thing I always used to do is there's some clients who would think that, in fact, I've had several clients that told me over the years, well, look, I always reject several of the people that are presented. Now, wait a second. I put a lot of work into this.
Yeah, there's nobody bad in this group, right?
And you're just going to see them. And I had a particular client who was famous for being difficult to work with. And I said that to him. And he gave me this business, well, which one of these should I see? And I said, no, you're going to see all of them. You don't get the program here.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is going to be the end. And the head of human resources had told me, you know, our president is impossible to get along with.
Right.
He's just impossible. I apologize for that. But here's the assignment. I want you to do it. So I got back to New York. And I had a phone call from the head of human resources. She said, John, you wouldn't believe it. So the president was walking from office to office to office saying, did I ever find a fabulous consultant? I really found somebody great. And probably because he had everybody intimidated, including the head of human resources.
Right, right.
Everybody just said yes. Oh, you want it upside down and backwards and green?
Sure, happy to do it for you, sir.
Get me the green fountain pen, you know.
Okay, so you said something earlier. You said one piece of advice. You said make yourself known. What might you say to a young manager, maybe somebody making about $100,000 a year, in addition to recruiting firms, how can he or she make themselves known?
Well, it's important. Networking is really important. And I make a distinction between the two kinds of networking, one much more fertile than the other. Mm-hmm. The one that's really fertile, it's really productive, the people who already know you, know you're good, know why you're good and how you're good. Those people are golden. And even if you feel you've lost touch with some of them, and for this person just starting out, maybe it'll be a noted professor from the business school.
Okay,
or something,
okay, right.
You know.
Okay.
It may not be the CEO of some other company.
Right.
It may not be the CEO of any company.
Right.
But it's networking with the people who think very highly of you. That's extremely productive. It's also good to branch out from there and get a suggestion, and then somebody else suggests, somebody else suggests. But the impulse to help you and to really stand up and say you're great has got to get weakened every step of that.
The further away they are.
Yeah, the further away.
Yeah.
So making yourself known to people who know you and think well of you and would want to try to help you, that really would. And that is done, now we're going to move maybe just a suggestion that goes beyond the beginner.
Right.
But for the person who's an established person with quite a track record and so on, they are prepared, they're appropriate to be tucked into a job. And if the person that they're talking to is, let's say, CEO of a huge conglomerate or even a sizable company, there's every likelihood that if the person wanted to, they could hire him or her.
Right.
So the trick is, I always recommend that people ask for a reference rather than a job.
Right.
Because they'll be happy to be a reference. They'll say, yes, absolutely. If you pin them to the wall and say, have you got a job for me? They're going to have to say, well, no, I don't.
No.
And then what they do next is to give you 14 reasons why not.
Right. And then they've talked themselves out of helping you any further.
Exactly.
Yep.
Their mind has gone from positive to negative.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you say, I may need some references, I'm thinking of changing my employment, would you possibly be a reference for me? They say, oh, sure, I'd love to help you. Now, you remember
this
the great things that we did when we were together? What have you done since? Tell me about it. And the very things that you would wish that you could present, you're asked to present.
Now, I have to interrupt you here, John.
Yeah.
This is the moment. There were two moments in the book. The first moment was when I read the book years and years and years ago, was when it said, this is what I tell my friends. I thought, oh, finally, a book that cuts through it. And the other one was when I read that, because when I read your guidance to ask for a reference, I thought, okay, that's the kind of a bit behind-the-scenes knowledge, and it just struck me as the whole, that person who you're asking will see you completely differently if you ask for a reference rather than a job. And when I read that, I can remember very clearly going, huh, this is it. So, folks, if you're listening and you didn't know that was in the book, what that proves to you, as important as that moment is in the book, you haven't read the book and you need to go get the book. It's the only book. Is it not the only book that we say this is the one book we represent in one industry?
Yeah.
I mean, we have other books about management. We have lots of books about management.
Well, management is a different matter.
Yeah, totally different.
I'm not doing that.
Right.
But with respect to recruiting, actually, we've been very fortunate. I have, because the book first came out in 1986 and immediately became number one in the field of executive job changing and even careers, executive careers. It's been number one every year since, and it still is.
Yeah.
It sold 400,000 copies, and I figure, as far as I know, it's roughly 20 times as many copies as any other book. And so what I say to the people, if I don't try to sell it, but if somebody is asking about, I say, well, look, make an algebraic number, call it X. Let it represent everything that you don't currently know about the job-changing process that you're in.
Right.
Because most people think they do know it. They somehow think it's common sense, they were born with it, and yeah, there's nothing right. that kind of can be contributed in addition.
We know a few people like that.
Yes, we do.
And you know, and so I say, well, let X represent anything that you don't know on this subject. Then if you read the book from the front to the back. Now, you don't skip around and just kind of cherry pick little things here and there. But if you go all the way from the front to the back in sequence, and you feel you have not learned 5X, five times what you thought was the maximum when you started, then send it to me and I'll give you double your money back. Well, I made that offer to people that I talked to one-on-one for years, and I didn't get any, ever, in all the time. I've never had a request for money back, but I've had things like orchid plants, bottles of champagne. Somebody sent me a check for $350. I don't know how he chose that particular number. I think he got a $350,000 job or something.
Okay.
You know? But, and I never cashed the check. I framed it, so he was a winner on that one. But anyway, it's it will help. It will help.
When you think about managers and executives doing job searches, we often get asked questions. There's one part of our website called the forums where people go in and ask questions, and where we cringe a little bit when we hear their question because we know they've made a mistake or they're getting ready to make a mistake, and you just want to say no, please. When you think about in your career, what's the biggest mistake that you wince at or that you wish, if you could share with managers, say, please don't do this one thing that so many people do, it's so simple to avoid, what would be the biggest mistake you see that you want them to stop?
Well, mistakes may be two kinds. When people are laboriously calling up retainer recruiters and saying, did my resume come in the mail? 99.999% of the time, the mail is delivered.
Right. Postal Service does a pretty good job.
Right.
So it's so lame to call up and do that, and such a waste of time. On the other hand, there's lots of productive stuff you could be doing, and if you're really doing a good job at looking for a job, you're spending full time on it.
Right.
You're working at least 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and maybe 6, 7 days. Who knows? Mm-hmm. You're working hard all the time. And if you're doing unproductive things that really don't lead anywhere, let's cut that out and switch to doing something, you know, more productive.
How long would you, in general, how long should somebody expect to find a job?
Well,
what should their mindset at least be going into that?
Boy, I'll tell you, I would go in without an outrageous expectation. I wouldn't go in there saying that it's going to take me a week for every... Years ago, they used to say a week for every $10,000 of compensation.
Right.
Well, compensation has gone up and time has not increased.
Yeah.
So that's not true anymore. But the best thing is not to come up with some narrow expectation, say, boy, if I do a good job, it should all be over at a certain time. Problem with that is if it doesn't work out, and you might beat that. You might very well beat that time by a lot. But if it doesn't work out that way, then you're beating yourself up and saying it was...
You work less hard after that day.
Yes, you
That's
say, this is a daunting thing.
Yes.
It doesn't work. They're all against
me. I must be wrong.
Yep. Yeah. And you know, it's the world is against me. Let's see if they have any jobs at Starbucks, so that is... incidentally, Starbucks is a great company, and some people have done very, very well.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, there would be... other things that people do wrong. On a more conceptual level, a 30,000 foot level or something, I would say it is not realizing that getting a job is a competitive undertaking. There's no good job that doesn't have several people competing for it.
Desperate for it, even, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you've got to figure what these other people are going to bring to the party. They're probably going to bring a direct experience with a competitor.
Right.
They're going to bring years of knowledge of the same thing. They're going to bring a lot of stuff that somebody, the decision maker, or even the screening people in the personnel department could hold against you and say, well, of course, you don't have this.
Right.
But those kinds of you don't haves and negatives are usually brought out after something else you've done that that they're really
they're
willing
to say. They're justifications for,
Maybe they think you're too old, or maybe they think you're gender is wrong, or whatever it is, they're prejudiced in some way. They can't say that, so then they come up with other stuff. So the trick is, you've got to figure out what it is that is your best thing to sell, and also what are the objections that anybody might have.
To your, to your particular background.
Yes, and to you. Naturally, it pays to be... attractive and nice and all of that. You don't gain anything by being testy and
rude and short and
Now it's important that you figured out what the company probably needs. Surely I wouldn't go for an interview with a recruiter, or forget the recruiter, especially not for anybody in the company, without having read every single word that's on their website. I mean, I even go to the things that talk about news releases. And news releases, as far back as the website shows them. So if they've got news releases over the past 2 or 3 years, fine. Right. That's okay. One time annual report is enough. But news releases are really interesting because it shows what they were saying and what they thought was going to be a big winner for.
Right.
And it may not have become a big winner, you know.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as you bring it up in the form of a question rather than, I guess you really struck out when you tried to do that acquisition. No. How has that acquisition worked out? That's something that I could certainly help with, you know, because my background, boom, boom, boom. The thing that people don't tend to realize is that it's competitive.
Right.
And they have got to analyze the market. And they've got to think in terms of persuading somebody, and they've got to think not only what the advantages are, but what are the shortcomings, and they're going to look for ways to prove that the shortcoming is not disabling.
Right. We tell our listeners often that, and we have a whole series on interviewing, one of the things we say is you need to know the market, and you also need to know yourself. I'm surprised when I interview people, I'm sure you're familiar with behavioral interviewing. I'm amazed at people who, when I look at their resume, it would appear, okay, this person's done some good things. He's in the ballpark.
Right.
And of course, we only interview people whose resumes make us think they're in the ballpark, right? And then I sit with them, John, and they can't communicate it. They can't verbally communicate it.
Well, you know, I can agree with exactly what you're saying, but I also see a danger, too, in attempting to do that.
Okay.
Because there is a very widespread opinion that you should communicate, I hate jargony words like skill set.
Right.
But you should communicate your skills, communicate your wonderfulness, what's so great about you. I'd rather that your person who is interviewing you, making the decision, screening you, that they can infer from what you present by the way of achievements that you must have certain skills.
Yeah. There you go.
And
that's what we tell
even
them.
Maybe quotations from somebody else, but always... self-praise is not...
No.
It doesn't...
But what I find is, here I'm interviewing this fellow, and I say, hey, tell me more about this experience. And I would assume...
Oh, and he doesn't even have it freshly in mind.
He doesn't have a 2 to 3 minute answer that I can probe in and say, well, tell me more about that negotiation, because I want to know if his negotiation style is like our corporate. And he says, well, it went well. And I said, well, tell me how... what made it go well? What did you do to lead up to it?
Exactly.
And he says, well, you know, it was a negotiation. I said, well, yeah, I know that. It's on the resume.
Right.
But where's the depth for me to say, you're our kind of negotiator, for instance?
Well, sure, exactly. Yeah. Whereas if you went into hostile territory and you managed to get a competitor to agree to a mutual marketing arrangement or something.
Wow.
And you say, you know, we know that you can negotiate.
Yeah.
And for years, nobody had achieved anything like that, but, you know, now you have.
Right.
But it's... even just a very fundamental point that you're bringing up that deserves to be just kind of polished and presented a little more, that is that there are a lot of people who have not read their resume recently. They don't even know what's on the paper. And when you ask them, now, people are going to listen to this and they're going to say, oh, well, nobody would be like that. These guys are telling us stuff that we don't need to know. Yeah, I don't know about that for sure.
We have plenty, you and I and Mike, we have plenty of data of people sitting in front of us, talking to us, and not being able to amplify on the resume, let alone something else.
Exactly.
We don't know what to ask if it's not in the resume.
And how are we going to believe it if they can't present it?
Yeah.
Why are we going to be able to believe it, number one, and communicate it, number two?
Right.
I had somebody one time in response to a question about a particular job for a particular time period. His answer was, I had that on my resume.
And yet here John and I are sitting going, well, it's not outside of the realm of possibility that that would happen because we've seen, crazy.
Yeah, that we've seen.
Yeah.
All right, folks, that's it for part one. And since we've been less than time limit on our monthly members only cast of late, you won't have to wait long for part two. We'll put that out next week. Now, one additional note before I go. If you're a premium member, make sure you check out our website announcement of our new enhanced premium members podcast feed. If you're using an iPod or an iPhone, now you can get the podcast, starting with the July cast, in an enhanced feed with chapter marks, and in the case of a video iPod or iPhone, premium content slides embedded in the podcast itself. That's right. So, if you want more details, check it out, www.managertools.com. Well, that's it. And we'll see you on the members-only cast next week. So long.